Wake Up Call continues here on 1300 WTLS, 106.5 FM. And a real honor to have Robert Scroggins join us here in the studio this morning. The World War II veteran who flew in a B-17 back in the war, and some 70 years later, he got to get back in one here just recently and do it again. Good morning, Robert. Appreciate you being here, Mr. Scroggins.
Thank you.
Yeah, glad you're with us. Let's go back to when you were called to service. How old were you when you were called to go to World War II?
Well, I was about 18 years old when Pearl Harbor came along. The next day, one of the next two or three days, there was three of us went down to Montgomery to join up to the Air Force. And it was Doug Culpepper, Wallace Reed Melton, and myself. We were graduating from high school together. It was a lengthy test you had to make down there on paper. And we went in and took the test, and they flunked it, and I passed it. They begged me to go across the hall and join the Marines with them. But I didn't. I stayed with the Air Force. And everything was fine until I took the physical. And I was 4 pounds underweight. And
what was the weight requirement then? How much did you weigh?
Oh, I don't know. That's slightly over 100 pounds. Wasn't much. But anyway, I went across the street and I bought 4 pounds of bananas. And I ate them, and I came back, and I hadn't gained an ounce.
Yeah.
And there was an old sergeant on the, doing the test, and he said, "Son, you want to get in, don't you?" I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Well, the only thing that weighs inside of you, what weighs outside of you, is water."
Yeah.
So I stood on the scales, buck-naked, and he brought me glasses of water. Till he finally said, "That's close enough."
No kidding. Wow.
I don't know how close I got, but wow. he felt sorry for me. So I trained that at Maxwell. You know where the hospital facility is down there?
Yes, yes.
Okay, that was a big tent city. Matter of fact, during the war, tents is about all I lived in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was transferred down to Selma, Craig Field. Incidentally, on the side out of there, I got married when I was down there, too. Come back to Tallahassee. And then I want to start out to Texas, Ellington Field, Texas. It was all book work. We had to do all kind of math, everything, just like a college. I got through that all right. And I finally got out to West Texas, and actually got in an airplane. And it was a bomber. We dropped smoke bombs and things like that. And I finally got through that, and I went to out to California, out the desert. Finally got on a bomber crew, and we trained there. It was so hot. The runways were melted, and we went up to Rapid City, South Dakota. We left South Texas, and it was wearing shorts and burning up, and there was several feet of snow when we got up to Rapid City, South Dakota. Well, we got on a crew and went overseas and got to flying with the 8th Air Force, the 95th Bomb Group. I flew with them the rest of the war. Now, in those days, your requirements was you had to do 25 missions. Well, I stayed on our crew till we got to 25 missions, and they all came home except me, and I stayed in. Now, we had somebody exciting of a bus time. On the 4th day of January, 1944, on a raid to over to Germany, we got shot up real bad. And we decided that one engine was on fire, and we decided some of the crew wanted to bail out and give themselves up. But we decided to try to make it back to England. But we didn't make it. We went down in the North Sea on a very, very rough day. The way the British wrote up the weather that day said it, and I like this little phrase, it said, it was bitterly cold with a freshening wind. But it was. But we hit, and it's when I come to, I guess, the scariest moment of my whole life. I was to be the last one off of the airplane. We had practiced this several times. I sat down on the floor in the radio room and crawled up under a radio set and braced my head against it for the crash. Well, as soon as we hit, I guess we went on and pop back up. The water was that deep. That
up to your nose.
Right, yeah. Up to my nose. I could not get my nose out under that water. Mm. And I could see the little waves all over. I could see everything. I know it wasn't over but a few seconds, but it seemed like forever.
Yeah.
I finally decided I could duck down and get out from under that radio and stand up. And the water was just a little over knee deep in the plane, and it was sinking fast. Now, the B-17 was equipped with two inflatable life rafts. And the first man up pulled two levers, and those were supposed to pop out and inflate. Well, they popped out. One of them inflated, one of them didn't. Mm. Now, we had to get around that, but it didn't inflate. And the radio operator was either smaller than I was. And we got him up in there, and he pumped it up with a foot pump. And we got in there, and we finally got the two rafts tied together. Now, when we went in, when we were flying back, we were escorted by two British fighter planes. And they were radioed in and all. And they sent a seaplane out there to try to pick us up. It was what they call a walrus. It was a pusher plane with a prop in the back. But he could not land because the sea was so rough. I tell you what, those waves to me looked like they were mountains as they was coming in. Cold, it was freezing, ice we were freezing over. He couldn't land, but he did drop smoke bombs all around us. A smoke bomb was a wooden bomb that floated in the water. When it got wet, it started giving off real dark smoke. And not too many miles away was a British destroyer, the HMS Verdun. Now, the little thing about that ship, it was a coal-fired ship. I had never given any thought to what a ship did, but I learned in a hurry. But they had been down there shoveling that coal in there all the time, in the steam. Well, he came by us, and he shot a rope out there to us, and he missed. And he come back around again. He said he couldn't stop because of submarines in the area. Mm. But anyway, he shot another one out, and we got a hold of that one. And they slid us all up on the deck of the destroyer. The HMS Verdun was a World War I ship.
Okay.
It was made the last week of the war in World War I. Matter of fact, it brought that unknown soldier from Europe back to England in that ship. Mm. They ripped all the clothes off of us, just took knives and cut us all our clothes off, and started dashing water on us. And it brought out a little wooden keg. It looked to be about a gallon. And it opened up, and there was rum. I couldn't drink it. But anyway, we got that down. And like I said, I had never thought of giving any thought to what a ship did. But it took me down to the captain's quarters. And this has always been an amazing thing to me. He had a fireplace, just like you have in your house.
On a ship.
On a ship. Yeah. He set me down in front of the fireplace, and I started getting warm.
Cozy, huh?
And then they had dispatched a regular Ashley rescue boat, but it was going to be hours getting there in a rough sea. Incidentally, this one was headed for New York. If we'd have stayed on it, we'd have come to New York.
Yeah.
But they caught up with us, and they transferred us from the destroyer down to the little Ashley rescue boat. They strung a rope down to that line, and they put you in a canvas seat, and they put you on that rope and slid you down to that smaller ship. To tell you the truth, that was more frightening than the crash was.
Really? Wow.
But we got back to England, and they took away the clothing they'd give us, and they gave us British uniforms. And we finally got back to our post about noontime. And I was going down to the mess hall to get a little something to eat. And there was a young GI walked up to me and said, "Have you got a brother in the British Air Force? He sure does look a lot like you." But I never did tell him any different. But like I said, we flew the 25 missions. And the crew all came home except me. I stayed on the rest of the war and continued flying. Now, in July of that year.
That's 44, right?
44.
Yeah.
The 56th Fighter Group, which was Colonel Hubbard Zimke, a very famous pilot. Matter of fact, he was the best fighter pilot in the whole Army. I gave him credit for. He had got a hold of what they call a droop snoot. You know what a P-38 looks like?
Yeah.
Two engines, two birds. They had taken the guns out of the nose of that plane, and put a plexiglass nose on it and a bomb sight.
Yeah.
And it needed a small, crazy bombardier because there was no way out of it. They took the top off of the thing and it crams you in there and then put the top back on it. You didn't have to have a parachute. There was no way of getting out of it. But as a matter of fact, when the nose wheel came up, when he took all the retractors, it shared that little hole with me. But he wrote a book after the war, gave us a page in it anyway. He said, when Scroggins released the bombs, that we took a terrific hit. The plane went into a right-hand spin. He said, I happened to pull the plane out of the spin, and I looked out to the right, and the prop was gone, and the motor was gone. I looked out to the left, and that motor was still running, but it was leaking oil real bad. But he said, we got it back to England, and went in for a landing, and I guess we were going too fast. Anyway, we didn't have any brakes. And we went off at the end of the runway and down across a farmer's field and tore up the airplane. And I had to lay in that nose compartment until somebody got out there with some wrenches to take the top off and let me out. But he's two things. He couldn't repair the P-38. It was beyond repair. And I was going back to the 95th at my old job. But that was one great man. He later was shot down himself and was in a POW camp. And he was a full colonel. He was commander of that POW camp at the end of the war. All right, and in August of that year, Dad, we were had a real, I don't know how you call it, we were bombing the bridges in Germany. And we were to bomb the bridge in Cologne, Germany. And we were leading the entire 8th Air Force. That was supposed to be an honor, you know, to get to lead.
Mm-hmm.
We had a general flying with us in the co-pilot seat. He was in command of the whole thing. And just as I started the bomb run, probably about 5 minutes out of the drop, we got a big hit right in the nose. And it knocked me out of my seat, back on top of the navigator who sat right behind me. It killed the navigator.
Wow.
It cut my oxygen supply off. I was wounded in my head, my right hand, and both legs. Now, the head wound was the most frightening. It was the least of my wounds. It was just a scratch across my forehead, but the blood was coming down in your eyes, and you were feeling to see if you had a top on your head.
Yeah.
But we've got that. I finally got good scramble back up. I got disconnected from the oxygen supply. And got that hooked back up and got back up on the bomb site and finished the bomb run. I didn't watch the bombs fall because the whole front of the plane was shot off just about it, and we were getting us all this wind. We got back as far as Brussels, Belgium, and we went in there. And I was taken off the plane by the infantry medics. And the only thing that they knew to do was sprinkle you. You would cut off a powder and give you a tetanus shot. And I must have had a half a dozen tetanus shots over the next 2 or 3 days. I finally got on a hospital airplane back to England. And being as small as I was, they had racks where they just stacked us in there and flew back to England. They put me right on the top rack. My nose was about 3 inches from the top of the plane. I guess I got a little claustrophobia, but
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I understand.
I like to fly. But I want to see out the window, see where I'm going.
Yeah.
But I got back to England, and this is something that's really true. It's fascinating. When I was wheeled into the operating room, started putting me back together, the surgeon that was going to operate on me, he said, "Boy, what part of Alabama are you from?" I said, "Well, you wouldn't know anything about it." He said, "Well, what was it?" I said, "Well, it was Tallahassee, Alabama, about 35 miles east of Montgomery." He said, "Well, hell, I'm from Clarendon, Alabama." It was Dr. Sam Upchurch. His daddy ran Upchurch Drugstore in Clarendon. And he put me back together, sewed me up. And years later, I took a friend up there for him to do some surgery on. And I got to talk with him and made a good impression. I really liked that fella. Now he came back to Birmingham and made a fortune in plastic surgery. But he died young in life. Had a big farm and I got to visit. But that's really, really nice to come back and see him. I stayed on to the end of the war and flew home in a B-17. And we landed in Iceland and refueled, and we landed in Bradleyfield, Connecticut. And another funny thing that happened there, when we got off of the plane and we had a trailer truck on the back of it, and a Red Cross woman coming running up with a gallons of milk, ice cold milk, and cookies we hadn't had any of that in 3 years.
Yeah.
But I stayed on in there. People talking about coming home for a veteran, how you accepted at home. I don't know why you ever remember my father or not, but he was in the furniture business there for all kind of businesses for years. And he had a store over the East House in the end there. I was separated from his service in Atlanta, Georgia. And I caught the midnight train to Montgomery, Alabama. And I caught the Ingram bus line to Tallis, Alabama. And I got out, it was just a little after daylight in East Tallis. And I walked in the store and greeted my father. Now, my daddy was the hardest working man that I've ever known. And he believed in just work. And it tickles me when it's all over with. But I said, Daddy, after we greeted each other, I said, can I take an old truck or something and go see my wife and daughter, Pat. Pat was born, I never had seen her.
No kidding.
She was walking and talking, and I never had seen her.
Wow.
But anyway, he said, can I get an old truck, go down? Yeah. But how about delivering this on the way? And that's the way he was. But I was my welcoming back home.
Back to work again, huh?
All right, Bill Vanessa called me a little short while later. I don't know if I was an Army officer, and I told him, yeah. I was a major at the time. He said, well, he was forming a National Guard company in Tallahassee. He wanted to know if I wanted to get into it. I said, well, might as well. He said, well, you'll have to take a reduction in rank. He said, I got the captain slot, and you can come in as a first lieutenant. Well, I joined up with the National Guard, the first lieutenant. There was three of us in the Guard, me, Bill Bonanza, and Max Kinsall.
Is he one of the ones that you were? Yeah, right.
We started getting people into the Guard. Of course, in 1951, was it? Career service, we got called back into the service, and I was a company commander of the Headland, Alabama company. And we got through that, and I stayed on in until I was 60 years old.
And you served in Korea as well?
Yeah, I did not get to Korea. I was in the training part of it.
Yeah.
I came unglued. You people don't realize how poor the Army was at the start of that Korean War. They had cut everything out. And I had to send, there was one that called down for a quota of what we had to send to Korea. And I had to send men on a recoilless rifle, sergeants, over to Korea to be a squad leader. That had never even seen their weapon fired, let alone fired. We were in bad shape. But we stuffed that out all right. And like I said, I stayed in till I was 60 years old. And I got out and I retired from the post office and the National Guard on the same day.
How many years did you serve in the post office?
35 years.
Yeah. You were the postmaster, right?
Yeah, postmaster, yeah. Remember your mother and father real well. Got all their mail every morning in a big old box.
Yeah.
Well, that's about the nutshell of what I've done.
That's impressive, goodness gracious. Impressive.
Well, Mr. Scroggins, I got a question for you. How many flights did you make? Do you know your count of how many?
I didn't keep an accurate count.
You did the 25, obviously, and then beyond.
I did the 25 and kept on flying. I would guess somewhere around 50, but I didn't keep a record of it.
You shot down three times? Right,
three times.
I just can't imagine. You said you were in that modified P-38, but it was almost always the B-17. Was that correct?
Yeah, I went back to the B-17.
Were you the bombardier?
I was a group bombardier in charge of all the bombardiers.
All right, so you're coming in today because you just got to fly on one of these again after all these years.
All right.
What was this like? Man, how did this opportunity come about to get back in a B-17?
All right, this plane here, as you see here.
Right. What is the name of it? What does it say on the hat there, Trey?
It was in
the aluminum.
Aluminum overcast.
Aluminum overcast. Okay.
It was in Montgomery.
Right.
About 2 or 3 months ago. And they took me for a ride in this plane. That's something else that's real funny. We flew all around Montgomery. I tried to get them to come to Tallahassee, but they had a set route they had to fly. I got to set up in the Bombardier seat for the first time, in 65 years?
Wow.
And I really enjoyed it. And when we got back down on the ground, I told the pilot, the co-pilot, how much I enjoyed it. And I said, there's one thing different from what it used to be. There was nobody shooting at me.
Yeah. How much gunfire or whatever do you think you saw? I mean, it's probably, you can't count it all.
Constant. I had two guns, two 50 caliber machine guns down on the nose of the plane, and I had controls up here that I personally fired. Now, going back to that, I know I got credit for killing thousands of people, but most of it was from 25,000 feet up in the air.
Yeah.
But this one particular time, we were flying down over southern France, and it was a little plane came up. It was a two-seater. It was a German plane. It had a pilot in the first compartment and a gun in the second part, and he had a gun that he could swing around. And he pulled up right in front of us, not as far as being in the highway, right in front of us. I never could understand that, but he was desperately swinging that gun around, trying to get a shot on us. And I cut loose for those 250s, and I could see the hits over there on the plane. Mm-hmm. He wasn't less than 100 yards in front of us. I assumed that he was a trainer. I didn't know what he was doing. But that's the only two people that I really knew I hit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That bubble that you're in the nose of the plane, it's kind of a death trap, isn't it? I mean, really, for a lot of these airmen that went up, they didn't come back when they had that position as the bombardier like you were.
Yeah. Well, it was a 10-man crew.
Yeah.
You had a sergeant in front, you had the bombardier. The navigator was right up against me, but high. The pilot, the co-pilot, the top turret gunner. Then you went through the bomb bay. You got the radio operator. Then you got the bomb down, the gunner down under, the two-way gunners, and the tail gunner. So it was a 10-man crew.
Yeah. What was this flight like for you, other than there was no gunfire coming at you, to get back up in a B-17 just recently?
Well, one thing funny about that, they didn't charge me to ride on this plane. They were getting $400 for a ride.
Yeah.
But anyway, the crew chief on the plane, when we landed, he said, hurry up and get off. We got to get some paying customers on this airplane.
You know, it's interesting because they had one come through Montgomery a few years prior. It's been back in, I think, 2008, because I was just looking back at our photos because I got an opportunity to fly in one of these myself. And I saw that it, a couple of years after that, had crashed in Chicago. It was called the Liberty Bell. There aren't many of these B-17s left, are there?
No, very few of them. Now, this particular plane here did not get in the war. It was only assembly line when the war ended. Mm. And this did not actually get into combat with this plane.
Well, Mr. Scroggins, I can, you were saying that you asked him to come over and fly in Tallahassee. Now, if it ever comes back and you want some fire and on that plane, if you'll go down there and crop dust a couple of these cotton fields down here, we can get you some firing on you down there. I can get a couple of guys stand out there and shoot a couple rounds off at you out there if that's what you want.
How old are you now, Mr. Scroggins?
93 years old.
Man, you are very impressive.
Yes, sir.
The account that you have is one of the unbelievable stories. Has anybody ever thought about writing a book about your story there? Or have you ever been approached about that?
Okay.
Maybe Trey Taylor, babe. You're pretty good at writing, Trey. Yeah, you may do that.
That'd be a great story.
It is
because,
a great
story. Because, I mean, you sit there and listen to Mr. Scroggins talk about this, and, you know, I've watched the movie The Biloxi Belle on Mr. Scroggins, and knowing your life expectancy in a B-17 wasn't very high, was it?
Bombardier position, any B-17s and all of the bombers was the worst place to be in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Because the planes come in right at, they were hitting you first before they hit the rest of the plane.
Yeah.
Well, it's impressive. Thanks so much for coming in and talking to us about it today.
All right. Yeah. Thank you.
Hope you can come back sometime. Yeah.
All right.
Well, thank you for your service, Mr. Scroggins. We really appreciate it. I appreciate you fighting for my freedom and, you know, giving me the right to be out here. I really do.
We both do. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Robert Scroggins, World War II veteran.
Let me get my ears back here.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Good job. We appreciate it.